Jack gasped, as Papa expressed his wish that Mrs. Causeway never suffer widowhood, but that he, above all men, could offer solace if she did. It wasn't difficult to see Papa's fantasy through the thin veil of his prose. He wished not only for Mrs. Causeway to be his mistress, but perhaps even for her husband to die so that she might come to live with us at Monticello. Despair rushed through me. This letter was such a betrayal of my mother's memory that I was eager to hurl it into the fire. Intending to destroy the letter, every scrap of it, I returned my attention to the pile of letters to make sure that I had all the pages. That's when my gaze landed upon my own name within the missive that sat atop the stack. Not in my father's handwriting, but in the hand of Mr. Short. It was a scribbled note to a painter of some renown, from whom my father had commissioned a miniature of himself to give as a gift to Maria Causeway. Mr. Short might have taken it upon himself to cancel such an unwise commission, but instead, he requested the painter make another miniature for me. More astonishingly, Mr. Short asked the painter to pretend the request came from my father. This gesture, at once thoughtful, gallant, and modest, moved me deeply. It also shamed me, for there I was, snooping about in Mr. Short's desk. I began to wonder how many times Mr. Short had secretly interceded on my behalf. How many men with such responsibilities would take the time to worry after the feelings of a girl? How had I betrayed the trust of such a friend, even if my intentions were good? The full measure of my wickedness sank in like a stone dropping to the bottom of the sea, when the door creaked open. Mr. Short caught me where I should not be, still clutching my father's love letter. Given the soft look of reproach in his eyes, he knew just what I'd come here for and why. He came toward me, reaching wordlessly for the letter. "Don't make me wrestle it away from you, Patsy." I couldn't excuse myself, nor could I lie. Red-faced and miserable in my guilt, I let him take it from me, but pleaded, "Pray throw that letter in the fire." He replied with an indulgent chuckle, "I'd never do such a thing. Every shining word that flows from your father's pen is a national treasure." He was jesting, but I couldn't smile. "You don't know what's in that letter, or how it might embarrass Papa, or sully his honor." I hated that I had to speak the words, but it was better than admitting that my father was slipping back into the state of mind that nearly ruined him. Mr. Short gave a rueful sigh. "I have a rather good idea of what's in this letter. Your father confided that it was a debate between the wishes of his heart and the restraint of his intellect." Stung that Papa had confided in Mr. Short what he wouldn't confide in me, I said, "Then you know it's better burned. He compared himself to a lonely monk. How can he still be so unhappy when he has your company and mine?" Mr. Short started to reply, then snapped his mouth shut again before giving a rueful little shake of his head. "Oh, Patsy." My nostrils flared at his condescension. "Didn't you tell me that my father may rely upon you? Isn't it your duty to keep him from making an error in judgment? Send him this letter would be a grave error."
"Patsy, it's the very essence of liberty that a person be allowed to err."
And we both knew how I had erred in being there like a thief in the night. Mr. Short met my eyes.
"Besides, I'm the last man on earth who may judge another for unwise associations and attachments."
The notorious women of whom he and I had once spoken, the Belle of Saint-Germain and the married Rosalie, the Duchesse de la Rochefoucauld,
But something made me dare to hope that Mr. Short aimed this pointed remark at me. Was he forming an attachment to me, and did he think it unwise? And yet, his reference to those women made my face heat such that it took me a moment to find my voice. It's for God to judge, but perhaps you can advise Papa against—
I've advised your father to make a long trip to the south of France.
So he'd counseled my papa to go somewhere he might forget Mrs. Causeway. Perhaps it was good counsel. I didn't wish to be left behind in Paris, but I wouldn't be lonely. I had friends at the convent, and no harm came to my father when he traveled to London, save for the snubbing at the hands of the English king. As if to forestall objection, Mr. Short added,
"He can use the trip to investigate commercial opportunities that will enable our new nation to meet its financial obligations. It will keep him busy."
Yes, perhaps distraction and duty were exactly what Papa needed right now. Mr. Short's words were both cloak and candor, and I realized that there was no one else in the world who spoke to me this way. The garrulous Mrs. Adams spoke to me as if I'd become a woman of good sense. Papa shared with me his enthusiasm for science and inventions and architecture and music, especially music. But only Mr. Short ever spoke to me of politics, spies, and finance. Only Mr. Short seemed to believe I had some right to know more about the revolution my family had brought about. He didn't treat me like a child anymore. And that was for the best, because I very much wanted William Short to know that I hadn't been a child for quite some time. Thankfully, when Papa's wrist had healed a bit, he embarked on the trip to the south of France. As we stood together on the street in front of our embassy waiting for the carriage, I wished I could tell my father to forget Maria Causeway. I wished I could tell him to find joy in discovering the countryside and observing the beauty of nature instead of the beauty of a married woman. But I could say none of this without confessing that I'd read his letter. Instead, I let my breaths puff silently into the cold morning air, hoping he could divine my hopes in those little clouds of steam, hoping he'd sense my love, my longing for him to confide in me where he wished only to confide in others. Maybe he did.
"Patsy, I have a farewell gift that I hope you'll hold close to your heart."
He withdrew from the pocket of his embroidered coat a miniature portrait of himself. I pressed it against my chest. "Oh, it's lovely, Papa. I'll treasure it. Why, it must be one of a kind." In saying this, I hoped to give him an opening, a chance to confess that it was a duplicate of the one he'd commissioned for Mrs. Causeway, a chance to beg my pardon for remembering me only because of Mr. Short's kindness. I waited for Papa to say these things, ready to tearfully confess my own sins, eager for him to embrace me and reassure me that he hadn't forgotten Mama, and that he didn't intend to return to Virginia with Mrs. Causeway and make her the new mistress of Monticello. But Papa merely kissed my cheeks.
"I'll write to you so often you won't even know I'm absent from Paris."
Then he climbed into the carriage and was gone. Watching the wheels of Papa's carriage rumble down the street, I backed up the stairs to find Mr. Short waiting there. Still smarting with disappointment, I asked, "So, I suppose you're to be master of the embassy while Papa is away?"
"Custodian, anyway."
He clasped his hands behind his back, swaying with faux hauteur upon his buckled shoes.
"But since you've also been entrusted to my care, I'm uncertain as to which duty will be more trying."
He raised a brow, as if to remind me that he knew a part of my nature to which the rest of the world was blind. If you have any care for the prospects of my career, make certain I'm not forced to account to your father for bad behavior while in my charge.
I did have a care for the prospects of Mr. Short's career. I had a very great care. And so, when he next came to the convent to pay my tuition, I quizzed him on Francis' financial troubles, which, to my ear, sounded like a very grown-up topic indeed.
The finance minister has called for tax reform,
Mr. Short explained, as we strolled through the convent's inner courtyard past neatly trimmed shrubbery and an explosion of spring flowers in yellow, red, and pink.
And at least half the city stands insulted by the king's refusal to put the matter before Parlement.
I've heard the political quarrel has spilled out into the streets in scuffles, I said, a little ashamed of the thrill in my voice, especially since it wasn't the danger that excited me, but the nearness of Mr. Short. How had I never noticed before how noble a profile he had? And his green eyes? How could eyes be so strangely world-weary and enchanting at the same time?
Men will fight for liberty, Mr. Short was saying, sounding very much like Papa. But there's always a risk that fighting will descend into lawlessness.
Then I'm glad our revolution is over in America. Mr. Short's lips twitched up.
You think our revolution is over and done, Patsy?
Have we not wrested our liberty from the British?
We've won, at force of arms, the right to draw up a constitution. Yet you need look no further than your father's own plantation in Virginia, or indeed our embassy kitchen, to see that liberty hasn't been secured for all men.
My lips parted in astonishment. Mr. Short was unwilling to judge my father for his affair with Mrs. Causeway, but on the matter of slavery, I heard the very certain note of censure. Bristling, I said, I suppose the Virginia gentlemen of Spring Garden from whence you hail don't keep slaves?
Not this Virginia gentleman, he said, with a determined shake of his head. I entered this world with a small patrimony. I hope to grow my investments such that my fortune may sustain me, but I will not water it with the infamous traffic in human flesh. The practice compromises our morals and teaches us a habit of despotism.
His vehemence took me entirely unawares. I couldn't imagine this was a conversation of which my father would approve, but the lure of discussing anything with an impassioned Mr. Short proved too much to resist. Then what? What is to be done about slavery? Mr. Short turned us into the bright green hedge maze.
I haven't an answer yet, but I intend to join a society for effecting the abolition of the slave trade.
As we walked, Mr. Short explained to me his vision for a world where slavery was no more and men lived in equality and deference to the law. And for once, I didn't curse my long legs, for I had no trouble matching his stride as our shoes fell into rhythm together. I'd always taken him for a pragmatist, a shrewd man, if not an entirely virtuous one, but that day I learned he was a man whose ideals were as lofty as my father's, perhaps loftier. When he left me, I raced up to the bedroom so that I could stand at the window overlooking the street to watch him go. Marie came upon me and flounced atop the embroidered coverlet of the bed, propping herself up on one elbow in bored repose. When she glanced out the window to see the retreating figure of Mr. Short, her mouth formed a little circle of surprise.
Mon Dieu, je fille, you are smitten.
Nonsense, I said, not risking a glance at her. Mr. Short is merely a friend of long acquaintance.
Then why are you pink to the tips of your freckled ears?
At last, I decided it would do no good to hide it from her.
I spun on my toes in an excited pirouette. Do you think he fancies me? Whenever he visits, he stays longer than he is obligated to do. He had an artist paint a portrait for me.
Marie's expression fell.
Oh, poor Jeffy.
Has no one told you that your Mr. Short is infatuated with Rosalie, the Duchesse de la Rochefoucauld?
I pretended to dismiss it, waving a hand. That's a malicious rumor. She hesitated at my staunch defense, then concluded,
I think it's true that he's infatuated with her, but let's hope it's only rumor that they've become lovers.
Lovers? I was wholly unprepared for the flash of pain that burned just beneath my breastbone at the thought. Mr. Short was a man of 27 who spent his days with the cream of French society. Of course he took lovers. With sinking spirits, I decided that I'd been a fool. The reminder made me wonder how I'd ever so much as entertained the notion that he might take an interest in me. How ridiculous to dream for even a moment that a mere schoolgirl could compete for his affections with the likes of a duchess, no matter that she was another man's wife. Wounded, I kept to myself, finding comfort in the scriptures. I reported the political happenings in Paris to Papa by post, hoping to keep him apprised. But he didn't seem pleased by my interest in politics. My letters were all too often met with silence, and in one case, a veiled rebuke that I should attend ancient Latin texts and keep my mind always occupied to guard against the poison of ennui. How could I care about the translation of Livy with the world in such a state? Moreover, I wouldn't need to keep my father apprised of the goings-on in France if he hadn't been away, pining for the plumed and piffling woman who aroused his sinful impulses. Only you, Martha. That's what he swore to my mother 4 years before as she gasped her last breaths. I believed him then, and so did she. But what I learned about men in Paris, even American men in Paris, opened my eyes and bruised my heart. And so I wrote to Papa bitterly of the latest news, almost hoping to wound him. There was a gentleman a few days ago that killed himself because he thought that his wife did not love him. I believe that if every husband in Paris were to do as much, there would be nothing but widows left. To that letter, Papa did not reply. In the convent salon, clutching his smart tricorn hat and a nosegay of posies, Mr. Short said,
Patsy, I've had word that you were ill. I shouldn't have insisted the nuns rouse you from bed, but when you refused to see me, I feared.
It was only a violent headache, I said, pulling my shawl round myself for warmth, though it was springtime. The kind Papa suffers when he's upset. I didn't tell him of the mysterious pain in my side that had blistered up and caused me such suffering. No doubt elegant duchesses never fell prey to such unsightly maladies. If he was to find out about my blisters, he'd have to learn it from the bewildered physician, not from me. So I offered nothing else by way of explanation. Nor could I explain to him the wound on my spirit, one that had driven me, in prayer and contemplation, to a religious epiphany. What I couldn't tell him, for fear he might tell my papa, was that I had resolved to take my vows and join the convent. The idea had first come upon me in a sudden swirl of anger and resentment, and yet, during my illness, it had transformed itself into a genuine desire. Though I knew my father would despair to hear it, I was more contented at the Abbaye de Panthémon than at any other place I'd ever been. Immersed in its world of women devoted to each other and the betterment of mankind, I felt sheltered against the wickedness of Paris,
What's more, my dearest friends were always near to me at the convent, and I felt more suited to a life of reflection and scholarship than to a marriage or to a plantation to which my father supposed I must one day return. None of this, of course, could I tell William Short. At my silence, Mr. Short exhaled a long breath, then drew one of the purgatorial wooden chairs closer. I sat, careful of the shifting of my gown against my side. When he sat, he didn't cross his legs like a man of leisure, but perched on the edge, as if waiting for a verdict at court.
"Your father couldn't bear it if anything should happen to you, and under my watch."
"I'm quite recovered of my infirmity. You needn't worry for your career." Mr. Short scowled, extending the nosegay to me.
"Enjoy these in good health, then."
Taking the posies, a tenderness crept through me that I was forced to steel myself against. "Have you any word of my papa? Of my sister?"
"Your father's return has been delayed, but your sister is en route. I cannot imagine how your Aunt Elizabeth got the girl onto the ship, considering Polly refused to come. Your father is quite bedeviled by the child. She defies him as if he were no more to her than a strange beggar on the streets."
Polly had been scarcely 5 years old when we left her. Now she was nearly nine. She'd lived half her life with Aunt Elizabeth, and through our neglect, I worried that we had lost her as surely as we'd lost baby Lucy. It was a failure that gave me the greatest pain, and I was determined to live up to the promise I'd made my mother to watch over my little sister, which I could do right here in the convent. When Polly came to us in France, Papa said I must teach her to be good and to tell the truth, for no vice was so mean as the want of truth. But I'd teach her to be devoted, for that seemed to me a much more important virtue. Nuns were devoted. And if I was to be a devoted friend to Mr. Short, I knew that I must overlook the blots on his character, as he overlooked mine. So I determined to think no more about his pretty duchess. Nuns wouldn't think about his duchess. I took the posies and inhaled their sweet scent before drawing Mr. Short into conversation. He obliged me, explaining how anti-slavery sentiment grew hand in hand with constitutionalism in Paris. These talks, in which he showed respect for my opinions, made me think about new things and challenge what I'd been told. Challenge even my papa. And the next day, I wrote to my father. "It grieves my heart when I think that our fellow creatures should be treated so terribly as they are by many of our countrymen. Good God, have we not enough slaves? I wish with all my soul that the poor Negroes were all freed." In answer to this sentiment, Papa was also entirely silent. Chapter 8. London, 26 June, 1787. To Thomas Jefferson, from Abigail Adams. "I congratulate you upon the safe arrival of your little daughter. She's in fine health and a lovely little girl, but at present everything is strange to her. I told her that I didn't see her sister cry once when she came to Europe. Polly replied that her sister was older and ought to do better, and had her papa with her besides. I showed her your portrait, but she didn't know it. If you could bring Miss Jefferson with you, it would reconcile her little sister to the rest of the journey. The old nurse you expected to have attended her was sick and unable to come. Instead, she has a girl about 15 or 16 with her, one Sally Hemings." I was ready to fetch Polly at once, but my father bewildered me by sending a French servant to escort Polly from London instead, and I was outraged when Mr. Short let slip the reason why. Papa had urged Mrs. Causeway to return to Paris. The shameless woman had agreed, and because she was on her way, Papa didn't want to chance the trip to fetch Polly for fear he'd miss his paramour. Maria, Maria, Maria. That night, when Papa kissed me goodnight, I bit down on the impudence that tempted my tongue. But Mrs. Adams showed none of my reserve in her next letter, in which she tautly informed us. Polly told me this morning that since she had left all her friends in Virginia to come over the ocean to see you, you might have taken the pains to come here for her yourself. I haven't the heart to force her into a carriage against her will and send her from me in a frenzy, as I know will be the case, unless I can reconcile her to going. I was glad Abigail Adams's letter shamed Papa. I took greater solace that Mrs. Adams would reconcile Polly to join us, and that I'd soon have my sister with me once more. After all, I knew from experience that people found it extraordinarily difficult to hold out against Mrs. Adams. Weeks passed before the welcome sound of the hired coach turned from the Rue de Berry and into the courtyard of the Hôtel de Langeac. Hearing it, I rushed from the salon out to the front steps. As I held my breath, two girls stepped down from the carriage, their eyes wide with wonder and uncertainty. Oh, dear Polly! How changed she was. Still petite, with the blue eyes I remembered so well, but now a grown girl that I might have passed on the street without knowing. And yet, when I tried, I could see my mother in miniature. "Dearest Polly, I am overjoyed to see you," I said, hurrying down the steps. My little sister turned shy at the sight of me, sucking her lips in as she examined my face. I smiled brightly, holding my arms out to her. But they drooped when I realized that, in fact, she had totally forgotten me. The pain was an arrow to the heart, as sharp as any wound I've suffered. Reluctantly, Polly accepted my embrace, but then squirmed away, her gaze swinging over the house's facade. "Everything here is so grand." I grasped her hand. "I know. Paris is a wonder. You'll love it here. Come. Papa's eager to see you." As I guided her to the steps, I glanced over my shoulder at the slave girl. I hadn't seen Sally in many years, and she'd changed, too. If I'd ever doubted that Sally was my mother's half-sister, I was convinced the moment she said hello. She had my mother's voice. The soft lilt of her greeting was so familiar. And in truth, her appearance was strikingly similar to my sister's. Sally was a mulatto of fair complexion, but not so perfectly fair that the French wouldn't suspect she was a slave. And I worried what our French friends would think. I remember the words spoken against my father's reputation as our slave-holding spokesman for freedom. But perhaps Sally's resemblance to Polly would be to our advantage, for it was perfectly common here for lesser relations to take on positions as servants to their wealthier kin. Like all our Hemmings servants, Sally had been raised at the hearth of our family. She'd make a very fit companion in Paris, where she might learn a good trade, just as her brother had been doing with his cooking. When we entered the entrance hall, Jimmy Hemmings stood waiting, dressed in his chef's toque and work uniform. He bowed and offered a warm welcome to my sister and his. While the Hemmings siblings celebrated their own reunion, I led Polly into my father's study, where he leaped to his feet at the sight of us. My little sister stumbled back, still clinging to my hand as my father went down on one knee. "Don't be frightened, child." And when she smiled a little, he asked, "You know me, Polly, don't you?" She shrugged apologetically. "I think, upon seeing you, I recollect something of you, sir." It was another barb that dug its way into me. I had dreamed of restoring the happy little family that had laughed and sung in a wilderness cabin while hiding from the British, yet my sister didn't even know us. By evening, Polly and I started to overcome the deep sense of separation, and I hoped she'd spend the night in my bed, but she wanted to sleep with Sally.
"We had to trick Miss Polly onto the ship," the slave girl explained. "Mrs. Epps lured her onto the boat for an outing with all their children. Then we played with Miss Polly till she was so tuckered out she fell asleep in my arms. When she was asleep, the Epps family tiptoed off the ship and we set sail. Poor child woke up at sea with no way home but to swim."
Poor Polly. The sudden surge of sympathy redoubled my determination to do my duty by her, and I instructed myself to take no offense at the closeness she seemed to share with Sally. By week's end, we enrolled Polly in school with me, where we finally bonded over our studies. I tutored her in French, not wanting her to experience the teasing I had. I enjoyed teaching her, and basked when she complimented me as being a patient and encouraging instructor. Polly was intelligent, if occasionally too strong-willed, and quick to make friends. She adjusted far more easily than I ever did. She had an independence I admired, even if it caused Papa to fret. Indeed, she took him to task, boldly professing her resentment that he did not go to England to fetch her. She couldn't know it was because of Mrs. Causeway. I never told Polly how that woman clouded his judgment. No, I held that secret for him with all the others. She didn't love him. By God, nor ought she to have loved him. Why couldn't he see it? Mrs. Causeway returned to Paris at the end of summer without her husband, and I was no longer too naive to understand her liaison with my father was of a passionately carnal nature. Papa rented an apartment in the hermitage of Mont Calvaire on the pretext that he needed privacy from the bustle of our embassy, and it served to excuse his absences when he indulged in clandestine meetings with his mistress. But Mrs. Causeway was even less faithful to my father than she was to her husband. When unrest fomented in the city, with the king closing all political clubs and dismissing the Parlement, Papa was forced to attend American interests in the midst of the growing crisis, and Mrs. Causeway pouted and complained of it over dinner one night. I had to keep my gaze trained on my cutlet of chicken, for fear of her seeing the exasperation and disapproval on my face. One day, when Papa was away debating the merits of the newly proposed Constitution for the United States, I told her she might take comfort in his absence with the miniatures he'd given us. But she brooded that he hadn't commissioned them from her. She apparently had a very high opinion of her own artistic talent. If Mrs. Causeway loved my father, she'd have been his helpmate in this difficult time. If she'd loved him, she'd have been a balm to soothe his agitation. Instead, after only a few weeks, whenever Papa called upon her, she managed not to be at home. Then she called upon Papa at our embassy, only when she was sure he'd be out. Because of his bad wrist, he couldn't play the violin for her anymore, and they stopped going to the Follies or to the Royal Gardens or to the opera. She preferred to hold court at the reputedly beautiful Polish princess's salon, while Papa was swamped by a storm of political chaos. I shielded my little sister from all of it, and the convent was our refuge. And I was comforted by the routine of the place, secretly slipping in to attend Mass, for I felt the want of God. Alas! On Sundays we were often at the Hôtel de Langeac, where I worried for the lack of moral examples for Polly, especially when Mrs. Causeway was our guest.
One quiet afternoon, I asked my sister, "Would you like to learn from Jimmy how to make a pudding?"
Cheekily, Polly replied,
"Isn't Jimmy our chef? If he knows, why should we learn it?"
"Because Mrs. Adams once told me that every woman ought to know how to make a pudding." The mention of Abigail Adams was the surest way of convincing my little sister, and so Polly trailed behind me into the kitchen, where we found Sally near tears because Jimmy would only speak to her in French. Pleading amber eyes turned toward me.
"Miss Patsy, I'm supposed to take a tray up to your father's chambers, but Jimmy won't tell me in a language I know what's to be on the tray."
"Jimmy, don't be churlish," I said, feeling sympathy for Sally. But Jimmy insisted.
"Sally must learn to speak the language if she's to live in Paris. Perhaps she'll learn it when she's sent away."
This forced Sally all the way to tears. "Hush, don't cry," I said, a hand on her shoulder, shooting a sharp look of rebuke at Jimmy. "Your brother has gotten very much above his station since coming to France. Why, he's become so sullen and secretive. Papa jests that he's forgotten how to speak English, but doesn't know how to speak French either."
"You aren't being sent away, Sally."
Sally stifled her sob in a napkin.
"I am. I'm being sent to take the pox."
This was a surprise to me, though it shouldn't have been. It made sense. My father believed cities like Paris engendered disease. I only wished he'd informed me of his intentions, because it sent Sally into a rare panic. Glaring at her brother, she said,
"And I might die of it, so you might never see me again. Then you'll be sorry."
She meant this to induce Jimmy's guilt for teasing her, but Polly's beautiful blue eyes filled with terrified tears.
"Do you mean you're going to die? Like my baby sister Lucy?"
"Of course not," I said, trying to comfort both Polly and the servant girl who shared my little sister's bed at night. "Polly, we took the treatment years ago. So did Jimmy. What's more, it didn't hurt very much." That was at least mostly true. "Why, Polly, you can scarcely remember it, can you?" Polly shook her head, clinging to Sally's skirts. "There," I announced. "Do you see? If it was so dreadful, don't you think you'd remember it?" Polly agreed, comforted. Sally seemed to be, too, and Jimmy hugged her before sending her up to my father's rooms with coffee and a pastry. But that night, Sally crept from my sister's bed to perch at the end of mine.
"Miss Patsy," she whispered, "your father told me I'm likely to get very sick."
"Yes." I remembered what my father said when I took the treatment. "We must take upon ourselves a smaller evil to defend against the greater evil. We must take upon ourselves a smaller pain in order to survive." Sally nodded gravely.
"But if I pass, I want Polly to have the little bell your mama left me."
I remembered it well.
"You still have it?" "In my bundle," she said of her small satchel of belongings.
Moved, I stroked her back between her trembling shoulder blades.
"You're not going to die, Sally, and I'll care for you. I've already had the pox, so I can stay with you until you're better."
I imagined myself wiping sweat from her brow, brushing her long black hair, and tending to her as gently as Papa once had tended to me. Alas, that was never a possibility. It wasn't legal to give the treatment within the city limits. So Sally was sent away to a physician's care, where she remained quarantined for the next 40 days. Which meant two things. First, that we spent 40 days in fright for Sally, not knowing if we'd see her alive again. And second, that Polly finally cleaved to me. Without Sally between us, Polly climbed into my bed. She let me take her shopping for clothes. She let me style her hair. Together, we played a hiding-and-seeking game in Papa's greenhouse and plucked dried and over-ripened Indian corn from Papa's garden to make a display for the table. In short, now that I was 15, I took upon myself Polly's mothering and cared for her as I promised my own mother I would. Unfortunately, this only seemed to free Papa to pursue his most dangerous impulses. In spite, or perhaps because of the way Mrs. Causeway made herself unavailable, Papa couldn't seem to shake her enchantment. When the weather turned cold during Advent, he planned a dinner in Mrs. Causeway's honor. Though he usually preferred small gatherings of friends, for her, he invited a large crowd of strangers, including exiled Polish and Italian royalty. I hoped at least the crowd would avoid the intimacy of a less grand affair. Jimmy prepared the feast. He was swiftly becoming an accomplished chef in the French style, whereas I still hadn't mastered pudding. But because I imagined myself to be the hostess of this dinner, he permitted me to chop carrots and onions while he braised beef in a soup of bacon, wine, and brandy. I tried to take note of the amounts of nutmeg and allspice he sprinkled in, but Jimmy worked fast, with a pinch here and there, as if he'd committed it to memory. I was obliged to watch a clock for 3 hours while the concoction boiled away, and while I should have been contemplating a way to ask my father's permission to become a nun. I imagined I was the wife of my father's handsome secretary, and that we had a house together just outside of Paris. It was only a fantasy, for Mr. Short had never expressed interest in taking a bride, and rumors hadn't ceased about his love for a married duchess, but I contented myself with harmless fantasies of domestic bliss, whereas the men in my life were apparently content with nothing but real congress with sinful women. As I dressed that night, I worried for the scandal Mrs. Causeway might cause, fluttering about my papa like a wounded bird. But when she arrived, Papa bounded toward her to kiss her cheek, whereas she turned her head so the kiss landed upon her ear. At dinner, she took the seat beside him as proffered, but slid it closer to a count of some renown, with whom she flirted shamelessly. Though I desperately hoped Papa would give up this affair, it was painful to watch it unravel before my eyes. Worse, I witnessed the exact moment my father reached to pat her arm, and she recoiled from the sight of the curled fingers of his injured hand, as if she'd only just realized he was twice her age. Papa looked away, his lips pressing into a tight line. She'd hurt him, and I felt furiously angry at her for doing so. If a woman was to surrender her virtue and risk eternal damnation, she ought to at least do it for good reason. I might have forgiven her if she'd sinned in the cause of love, but the way she recoiled from my father made me certain it was not her heart that led her to sin, it was her vanity. And I've never forgiven her for that. Not for her dalliance with Papa, nor for the way she treated him. God may forgive her, but I never shall. The only good to come of her rejection that night was the way it forced Papa to stiffen, as if awakening from a long, fevered dream. Perhaps my father had to suffer this humiliation in order to recover from the fever of Mrs. Causeway. Alas, it seemed that I had to be equally prepared to suffer humiliation when the dinner conversation turned to the Duchesse de la Rochefoucauld. Mr. Short's association with the woman was the cause of several veiled but ribald jests. I pretended at supreme indifference, while I surreptitiously fisted my hands into my skirts, agonized by my awareness of the man so close. I stared at the lace that peeked out from under Mr. Short's neatly tailored sleeve, wondering how far apart our knees were spaced beneath the table.
wondering, too, when I'd be humiliated enough by my own infatuation to stop wondering such things. The subject of mockery. Mr. Short only sipped at his wine with an enigmatic smile. There was no blush on his cheeks. Only mine. After a bout of raucous laughter, the Polish princess pointed at Mr. Short and accused, "You're overly fond of French girls." He replied with a sly glance my way, "Oh, I like Virginia girls just as much." All at once, my burning embarrassment became a different kind of fire, and I died a thousand burning deaths of pleasure. Mr. Short's amusing retort meant nothing to these people, who laughed at his defiant wit. But his eyes fastened on mine flirtatiously, and I finally knew with certainty that I hadn't imagined his affection for me after all. It was real. The dashing Mr. Short could have had any Frenchwoman in Paris. But he was looking at me in my blue gown with the golden sash. He was looking at me. And I felt suddenly as light and warm as the wisps of smoke that floated up from the silver candelabra on the table. That night, long after the guests took their leave, I couldn't stop spinning on my toes. Round and round I went into the bedroom like a whirlwind. Polly peeked up from her goose-down pillow in vague alarm. "What's wrong?" "Nothing at all," I said, falling into bed on a laugh. I was no longer certain I wished to join the convent, because I might soon have, in Mr. Short, a suitor of my very own. What's more, for the first time I could remember, things were just as they ought to be. My family was together under one roof, domestic tranquility the aim of our existence. Exactly what my mother had always wanted, what I'd always wanted, too. And a few days later, something even more wonderful happened. Mrs. Causeway left Paris. I learned this from Papa, who came in from the wintry cold with frost upon his wig and a crumpled piece of paper in his hand. "I was to have breakfast with her this morning," he bit out. "But I found only a note of farewell." Papa marched up to his chambers and stayed there. And though my father was always writing, that whole next week he sent not a single letter. Seeing me fret over this, Mr. Short asked, "Will you never stop wrinkling your forehead with worry for your father, Patsy? He's merely lanced a boil." Had Mr. Short also believed that Maria Causeway was a plague on our house? If so, why had he stood by and let her happen? She might return to Paris.
He wouldn't see her again if she did. If nothing else, Mrs. Causeway deprived your father of his goodbye, of a closing scene, of a way to make sense of it, categorize it, and put it in final order. He despises nothing so much as that.
He had the right of it, for he knew my father well. Papa might be miserable, but would soon be purged of it. What he needed was someone to tend to him so that he could distract himself with work, as he'd always done. Sally had returned from her ordeal in the countryside, hale and hearty, not a pockmark on her beauty, so I tasked her with being Papa's chambermaid. It was a cold winter, colder than anyone in Paris could remember, and I instructed Sally to keep the fires blazing at his hearth until Polly and I returned from the convent for Christmastide. In the meantime, at Jimmy's insistence, Papa hired a special tutor to teach the Hemingses French. I provided Sally with a new wardrobe from my cast-off clothing, so she'd look like a suitable maid to accompany us on social visits. Together, my sister and I took to the city, bedecked in new, elaborate dresses of our own, and Mr. Short sometimes accompanied us, playing the part of gentleman chaperone, while stealing little smiles at me whenever I glanced his way. Between this,
the gaiety of the holiday, and the passionate political debates on every street corner. It was all a delight. When Polly and I returned home the Sunday before Christmas, the embassy was alive with the smell of bread. Low candles and crackling fires warmed every room, and I was filled with an undeniable happiness. Polly and I shared tea and buttered rolls, and I showed her the Cabinet des Modes, a popular fashion leaflet in Paris. "Would you like a gown like this?" I was eager to dress her just as Mrs. Adams had dressed me upon my own arrival in France. And Polly was so much prettier, just like a little doll. What fun it would be for us, two sisters, to choose fabrics and ribbons and shoes together. But Polly just shrugged. She was less interested in clothes than in playing outside, so I tossed the leaflet aside. "Shall we go out and see the snow?" Polly's face immediately brightened. "Oh, let's!" We bundled up and went into the courtyard, where we made a game of throwing little balls of snow. To my surprise, Mr. Short joined us in the merriment. Under the threat of slushy snow packed in his gloves, I cried, "You wouldn't dare!" Mr. Short, cheeks pink from the cold, grinned at me. "Mademoiselle, I'm a daring man. The question is whether or not you'll duck away." Light-headed at his flirtation, I fluttered my eyelashes like a coquette. I could run. Packing the snow tighter in his palms, he narrowed his eyes. "If you run from me, Patsy Jefferson, I vow to give chase." I didn't think we were speaking of the snow game any longer. Nevertheless, I wanted him to prove it. Giddy, I grabbed my skirts and fled down the pathway. Our garden was nothing next to the snow-covered green majesty of the palace grounds, but that day, ours seemed more beautiful. The cold made my lungs tighten as I ran, laughing, but when Mr. Short chased, I began to feel as if it was each thud of my pounding heart that forced the breath out of me. In moments, Mr. Short caught me by the coat, spinning me to him. Alas, my heel caught a patch of ice, and my foot went out from under me. But I didn't fall, at least not right away. Mr. Short's arms came around my waist, and I crashed against his chest. Then we both lost our footing, and still laughing, fell together into a drift of snow. With my head cradled upon his shoulder where he lay sprawled, his hat blown away by a gust of snowy wind, I didn't feel the cold. Though the frigid melting water seeped into my woolen dress, I felt only the warmth of Mr. Short's breath on my face, only the heat banked in his eyes, only the strange desire that burned in me to take off my glove and trace his cheek with my bare fingers. Instead, I let my hand drift near to his, and nearly swooned when he hooked my little finger with his own. We hadn't touched skin to skin, but there was an unmistakable intimacy as his gloved finger linked, tightly but tenderly, with my own. We breathed in perfect harmony, bound so innocently finger to finger, even as we ached for more. It was a still and perfect moment. And then Polly ruined it all by pelting us with snow. Declaring herself the victor, she danced over us. Still breathless and exhilarated, we went inside to change into dry clothes. When we came down, Jimmy set out spiced cider, and Mr. Short suggested that we summon Papa to join us. I wondered, perhaps vainly, if Mr. Short meant to speak to my father about a courtship between us. It was with this question in my mind, veritably floating on air, that I went in search of my father. His sitting room door stood open, and I stepped into the room. "Papa!" Despite the warm glow from the fireplace, the room was empty. A noise sounded from Papa's chamber, the door to which was ajar. Crossing to it, I inhaled to call his name again, but what I saw made the words die in my throat. Sally stood in the center of the room, her back to me, Papa's coat gripped in her hands. He was smiling softly at her, with an intimacy that stole the breath from me. After a moment, Papa grasped the jacket from Sally, but no, he didn't grasp the material. He held her hands where they curled around the stiff collar. He studied her, as if he couldn't quite comprehend the contours of her face. And my heart thundered against my breastbone. I was frozen there on the threshold of the room, not quite in, not quite out. I didn't know what was happening, or why every fiber of my body screamed at me to look away. I should have. Or maybe I should have called out to make my presence known. But I could do neither. Papa was a tall man, and Sally was small. The way he stared down at her, the girl who looked so much like my mother. It wasn't the stare of an old man, a humiliated lover, or a widower resigned to bachelorhood. It was the stare of a man who contemplates damnation and salvation. Slowly, as if even he wasn't conscious of his movement, Papa leaned his face down to Sally's. As his eyes fell closed, her head tilted back, and he kissed her. I could make no sense of the scene unfolding before me. She was a girl my own age. She was my mother's sister, my own aunt. She was his slave. And though I knew, of course I knew, that Virginia plantation owners took slaves for mistresses, we'd been so long away from home, I couldn't believe my own eyes. He couldn't be doing this. My mind rejected what I saw clearly until he pursued her lips with more ardor and drew Sally close against his chest. At that embrace, I choked back the cry that worked its way up from my breast, where my heart raced so hard I saw spots. If Papa saw me, he mustn't see me. Fingers pressed over my lips, I turned away from the private heartbreaking moment and flew from the room. Chapter 9. It was my haste that made me stumble halfway down the stairs. Only a wild, wrenching grasp at the carved wooden rail saved me from a broken neck. Alas, the heavy fall of my feet echoed up the staircase and drew my father from his rooms. "Patsy," he called, peering over the banister. I froze, breathless, my belly roiling with shock and anger and revulsion. I ought to have pretended that I didn't hear him say my name. I ought to have hurried on, leaving him with only the sight of my back. I ought never to have looked up at him over my shoulder. But I did look up. There on the landing, my father loomed tall, a tendril of his ginger hair having come loose from its ribbon, his shirt worn without its neckcloth, the stark white linen setting off more vividly the red flush that crept up his throat. Was it shame for his behavior with Sally, or ardor? On the heels of giving witness to his behavior, the thought was so excruciatingly horrifying that heat swept over me, leaving me to wish I'd burn away to dust.
"Are you hurt?"
Papa asked hoarsely. I couldn't reply, my mouth too filled with the bitter taste of bile. Finally, I forced a shake of my head. He glanced back to the door, then back at me, his hand half covering his mouth.
Were you at my door just now?
No, I whispered, as much as I could manage under my suffocating breathlessness. And how dare he ask if I'd been at his door when neither of us could bear the honest answer?
Even if Papa didn't know what I'd seen, he knew what he'd done. He ought to have been downstairs with us. Reacquainting himself with the little daughter who still didn't remember him, he ought to have been sipping cider with the young man who